Welcome to the official Espigan podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Noisley.
Selma, thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here. I tell everyone at the beginning of these podcasts that we have a special treat for them, and of course with every podcast we do, but today's guest is perhaps even a bit more special, because I worked alongside her at King's College Hospital for something like 10 years. Mariana Samin is a hepatologist there, pediatric hepatologist, of course. And she's made her name, really, in my opinion, in teaching adult hepatologists how to take care of pediatric disease as the people who have those diseases transition into an age bracket where it's just not appropriate for them to be cared for by those who have been caring for them in the past. However, that is not what we're going to talk with her about today. Today's topic is the new wave. Is it a ripple? Is it a wave? She'll tell us. Of presumably viral hepatitis that has gained so much press attention and with which she's become familiar, working as she does at King's, which, of course, as a tertiary, quaternary referral center, has seen a good number of the cases from Great Britain. Marianne, lovely to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Let me say, first of all, that I've only seen one of these cases working as a hepatic histopathologist in Graz. Only one. And I'm not sure that it was anything different from something that we've seen under a different name. That would be the name of non-A through non-E hepatitis, which sometimes leaves the liver devastated and requires a liver transplant. Other times, the child just gets better, although maybe with a scarred liver. We've been hearing a lot about implicating adenovirus and implicating COVID-19 in what seems to be an upsurge in cases of this disorder. What's your feeling about the incidence of non-A, non-E hepatitis in the past and now?
And that's a very good question. And I'm sorry, I will have not been, it won't be able to answer that very accurately. And that is probably one of the topics to kind of discuss in more detail. We are very familiar as hepatologists and also pediatric gastroenterologists with the concept of children presenting with acute hepatitis, where they have a significant rise in their liver enzymes and can become rapidly unwell. And we also know that the children who present with acute liver failure, when we look at their kind of background, is that about half of the children will have this condition, as we describe, non-A to E hepatitis, which actually means that we've excluded the typical viral hepatitis viruses that can cause hepatitis and haven't really been able to establish. I must say that in the course of the last several years is that we do see several cases that present to our centre and I think to other centres as well with non-A to E hepatitis, and some of these children go on, become unwell and need a liver transplant. And we have previously identified adenovirus as a virus that has kind of contributed to this hepatitis. Having said that, what changed in April of this year is that there was a significant higher kind of amount or kind of more children presenting with acute hepatitis. And when further investigated, adenovirus did come up as kind of be more present when examined further.
It's not a different kind of adenovirus or the same kind of adenovirus. I must confess that the idea that adenovirus is implicated in non-A, non-E hepatitis is and has been a new idea for me. I've seen adenovirus take out a liver in an immunosuppressed patient, for sure, but not act as a trigger for a largely T-cell mediated acute inflammatory hepatitis. I'm still having a hard time getting my head around how adenovirus is starting to do this when, it, to my knowledge, it hasn't done it before.
Well, that's not been our experience, and we actually have been looking back at some of the children that came with acute liver failure for transplantation over the last few years. And there were definitely a group of patients where we found adenovirus positivity. That means that the virus was present at the time of the patient presenting. I think what's not entirely clear, and that's a kind of the fascinating thing, if you want, or the unknown thing about acute hepatitis, is that we don't exactly know, especially in this non-A to E group, what kind of causes the acute inflammation and destruction of the liver cells. And the question is whether there is a virus that just triggers the immune system, and then it's a reaction of the immune system to the liver that causes the problem rather than the virus itself. And I think...
Sorry about that. Keep going, please.
No, and I think that's one of the hypotheses that kind of are around the adenovirus, which, to be fair, it's kind of been found in at least two-thirds of the cases or more when looked for. And again, it's not that easy to kind of find the adenovirus, if that makes sense. If you look for it in the stools and in the respiratory tract where it can present, and a typical adenovirus infection does present often with diarrhea and vomiting and respiratory symptoms. But when we look at those samples, we haven't really been able to find the adenovirus, whereas when checking it in blood, we have kind of found this prevalence of about two-thirds up to 70% of the patients being adenovirus positive.
That helps me understand a little better. Well, the old parable of the blind man and the elephant, I've just been patting down one leg of the elephant and concluding that the elephant is very like a tree. I've been looking at explanted or biopsied livers, and I haven't seen adenovirus inclusions. I haven't seen adenovirus antigens, which makes me think that the idea of adenovirus as a trigger for something else is plausible. Now we have the question of, a child comes in with non-A, non-B, non-CDE hepatitis, and what are the elements along which you're going to weave your net to look for adenovirus thoroughly, completely? Blood testing, nasal swab, stool, what else? What do you see as a thoroughly worked up adenovirus candidate patient?
It is important to kind of go back a step, I think. And when these children present to us with acute hepatitis, which kind of potentially can progress to acute liver failure, there's two things that are really important. It's actually making sure that the child is extensively investigated, not only for viral causes of the hepatitis, including adenovirus, but other viruses like enterovirus, RSV virus, but also to make sure that we don't miss another underlying liver disease which has presented as an acute hepatitis. And there are certain conditions like acute liver autoimmune liver disease, typically when they present in younger children, but also rarer conditions like mitochondrial disease or other related liver diseases that can present in a similar way. So I think one of the important messages is that if you have a child with acute hepatitis, you need to understand how sick the child is at the time of presentation and how sick the child might become, so that it's really relevant to inform specialized services or kind of discuss the patient with the specialized service. And on the other hand, do a full workup. With regards to the virology, we've learned that it's important not only to look at the typical areas where we look for virology, like nasal swabs, throat swabs, urine and stool. And in particularly for the adenovirus, what we found is that the detection of the adenovirus has been kind of significantly better when you look on whole blood rather than just peripheral blood or the other areas like stools, urine, or respiratory secretions.
So not serum for adenovirus, not plasma, but actual whole blood.
Yes,
Is adenovirus hiding out inside leukocytes now?
That's a question that is really tricky for me to answer, because I'm in that respect I'm not an expert in that field, but that is definitely the information we kind of seen from the UK data when they looked for the presence of the virus. There was a kind of a significantly difference, and with whole blood having a significantly larger detection rate of the adenovirus.
I'd love to know if they compared whole blood versus serum, or compared whole blood with serum in individual patients. Because the idea that in order to find adenovirus, you have to squeeze cells and look at the juice using a PCR machine is, again, new to me. I am learning a lot here. Here we go now. Now the question, so you've got your patient, and now you've got your PCR results back. You know that you can't find any of the usual suspects. Is it time for the liver biopsy?
That's a good question. Our concern often with children presenting with acute hepatitis, and that's in general, is that the yield of getting a lot of diagnostic information from a liver biopsy is kind of small.
Take that back.
In the acute setting. And I think our main concern is that these children often, for the definition of acute hepatitis, often their clotting becomes abnormal. And these children can, as we know, rapidly progress to acute liver failure. And so the risk of having complications from the liver biopsy are kind of significantly higher than us getting a very useful information from the liver biopsy. And that's data, I think, that kind of is, it is probably, there is a space to do a biopsy in children who have a milder form of hepatitis and don't have an abnormal clotting profile. And the child is stable and the cause is unknown, then a liver biopsy would definitely be recommended. But in general, in children presenting with acute hepatitis with the possibility of deteriorating rapidly, we wouldn't advocate to do a liver biopsy in all these patients. And definitely they should be referred to a specialized liver center.
I think that goes with the last part goes without saying. The first part about the liver biopsy not being helpful, we're going to have to talk, Marianne. We really are going to have to talk. But I take your point. This came up not too long ago in Graz when a liver biopsy was obtained in a patient with acute hepatitis in whom this new non-A, non-E hepatitis was strongly suspected. The original testing PCR of this, that, and the other had not returned any adenovirus, but you never know, it could still be there. And the child had had a bout of COVID in February. So who knows? At any rate, the persons attending that child waited until I had looked at the liver biopsy specimen and had said, this is not Wilson disease, this is not a recognizable viral disease, and waited until then to start administering steroids. And when they gave steroids, oh, by the way, I should point out that that liver was full of killer T cells, absolutely full. So steroids went in, the child improved dramatically within a few hours even, and non-A, non-E hepatitis, but giving steroids did not worsen the condition, at least, which was a fear before the liver biopsy specimen was obtained. If you did perform a liver biopsy, then with all the other answers already in hand from PCR and whatnot, Would you start to give steroids right away, or would you wait until the histopathologist had had a think?
It's a good question. And again, I won't have a straight answer for you on this. We know that in some centers, they believe in using steroids for treatment of acute hepatitis. Again, in specific cases, kind of having excluded all possible etiologies, they do it even without having kind of histological support to do it, if anything. But again, that's not really standard practice. And I think Alex Ordis, again, probably one of the important messages of this talk is that we don't really have the data. And if anything can come out of it, and we are able to routinely kind of collect data on the prevalence of this acute hepatitis in the younger children in particular, which seems to affect this group, majority of the children are under the age of 5, and we will have an idea of how prevalent it is, because not all these patients actually go to specialist services, because if they have a mild disease and they recover, they might have contacted a specialist center, but they might not have to be transferred to them. So we really need to put in a lot of effort to have an idea how prevalent this acute hepatitis is, what the pattern of it is, how many children spontaneously recover, and then have an idea of is there any value in using certain treatments. But at the moment, there is no kind of scientific data or support to actually support this kind of routine standard management in these patients.
Good enough. So Espigan, it's time for Espigan to step forward, isn't it? And to say, when you have such a patient, this is what you must do in order to make a contribution to medical knowledge, and as well, to ensure that your patient is treated according to the best possible information on hand. You got something in the pipeline?
Yes, I think that is really important. And I think over the last few years, we actually have seen this really fruitful and really good collaboration within Europe, despite the UK leaving Europe with Brexit. We're not talking about Brexit, but I think, again, on this occasion, the Hepatology Committee, and that's mainly on the leader of Giuseppe Indolfi, who is the chair at the moment, but also collaboration with the ERN, with the European Reference Network for Rare Diseases, there has been these initiatives to kind of send out questionnaires. And again, what is really important to reach the biggest possible kind of audience is actually to collaborate together, and not everybody doing their own thing within a country or within a kind of an organization, but kind of just expanding. And there's been a lot of collaboration also with organizations that have kind of are particularly interested in infectious diseases, and we very much welcome that. So there has been a questionnaire going around, and there's some data coming out of the centres reporting cases to have an idea of the prevalence of the adenovirus, but also the acute hepatitis in general. And we've submitted a paper to the Journal of Paediatric Gastroenterology, Hepatology and Nutrition, just summarizing what the current state of affairs is with regards to this adenovirus, because there is a lot of press and there is a lot of, we also noticed a lot of anxiety amongst the general population about, is this something new? Is this something dangerous? What do we do? And of course, we shouldn't forget that the unknown of why is this kind of high wave of adenovirus hepatitis, how has this come about, the concept of children not really being exposed to the typical viruses as they were because of the isolation around COVID, or COVID playing a role in this kind of pathology we are seeing. Having said that, there's not really any good evidence at the moment, because when checked, there's only been a 15% of the children that had kind of COVID, but not really in a, most often in a kind of an asymptomatic way. But again, there's this kind of concept of why is this happening? And as organisations, particularly in ESPGHAN, I think we are there to summarize the current information available and kind of making sure that people are kept up to date, but also provide some guidance with regards to specialist centers, kind of acknowledging that we do see these patients every year. However, there's now a surge of patients. So is this something different and why is it different?
You're saying it's a surge. The surge has been going on for 2 months, 3 months now?
Well, I think the way it happened is that there was in the first reports were from Scotland in the beginning of April, where they kind of described these 10 cases of acute hepatitis. Now, just to kind of set the background of the UK, and to be fair, I think we are in a unique setting in the UK because as you know, the whole UK, the paediatric liver care is centralised in three centres in London, Birmingham and Leeds. So that means that patients from all over the UK are always referred for specialist advice to these three centres. And that kind of there's been a really kind of rapid response to this from the national organisations to kind of collect data. So what they did is actually they asked all the centres to look back at cases from January onwards. And the data we currently have are the data of retrospective and prospective data. So we know from the most recent data from the 19th of May that, for example, in the UK, there have been 197 cases. And there's some data from Europe as well, where there's the latest update is 125 cases in 14 countries of Europe. So the rapid response to kind of trying to find out what is happening, what they did is they looked retrospectively from January till April, and then from April onwards, prospectively.
And there really has been a surge starting in April. No problem. We're both eager about this topic, I can tell. Is that they have gone back and compared this with incidences in previous years.
Again, that's the issue. We don't have a good idea of prevalence of adenovirus in the general population. I know that there has been some data where they looked, this is from the European data, where they looked back at a period between 2019 and 2021. And that was in liver transplant centres, where they actually, over those 2 years, saw kind of an average of 3.7 to 4.9 cases that came for transplantation, whereas in the last few months, they've already seen 2.5. So there does seem to be something different from what we've seen before. But most kind of specialised liver centres will say that they have seen adenovirus in the context of acute hepatitis. But again, without knowing how prevalent it's been in the general population, with not all these children coming to specialised liver centres. Again, that's really, for me, the opportunity, not only for adenovirus, but to really get a better understanding of this concept of non-A to E hepatitis in children.
Is there a particular web link on the ESPGHAN page that sends those who are interested in this topic, who have a possible patient with this disorder, to a set of recommendations or even a telephone number?
That's not currently how ESPGHAN is really set up with regards to kind of advice. there is the what has been circulated is, as I mentioned, a questionnaire which has kind of gone to both Espegan and ERN with regards to advice. My recommendation would be that people contact the liver centres that they usually work with for further advice. In the UK, we have been having regular meetings with a whole group of different people, virologists, infectious diseases, pediatric gastroenterologists and hepatologists, to kind of come to a consensus. And that's going to be published quite soon, with some kind of guidance, who, when to refer, what to do, how to investigate, how to manage these patients, and what can be done in a local hospital, and what needs to be done in a specialized center. So from the UK, there definitely will be some guidance coming out. I'm not sure whether this has been formalized in the rest of the EU.
I'm glad to hear that Espegan is fulfilling one of its missions, which is to be a link and a support for pediatric hepatologists, pediatric gastroenterologists who are outside major or referral medical centers and who are confronted with the same sorts of problems that, well, I guess that all pediatric hepatologists and gastroenterologists are confronted with, but don't have the depth of backup that they might if that patient were being seen at a referral center. The recommendations, however, are they going to include recommendations for ancillary studies, for basic science studies, the sort of thing that can be done perhaps in a tissue specimen, such as a liver biopsy specimen? You know, I'm a histopathologist, and I do think there's a role for liver biopsy. Or in explanted livers, say just looking again at the inflammatory cell subsets, or looking at the tissue itself to see if adenovirus or even COVID or something else is present in the tissue.
That's a very good point, Alex. But I agree. I think liver biopsies are, of course, really important, and explants, and we need to learn. And I my understanding is also that within the liver tissue, this was speaking with Maisha, one of our pathologists in our weekly a multidisciplinary meeting, is that there is the question is of where to look for the adenovirus and whether it's not kind of in the typical places where we normally expect it to be. The other thing I think is really relevant, and which we are doing, is we sending some of the blood from our patients, after taking consent, of course, to the immunology team we collaborate with, to actually get a better understanding of what this immune response to the possible virus or to whatever's causing this it is, and whether that there is some information there. So I'm sure that we will get a lot of data and information, particularly from the prospective data collection, because again, that's been one of the issues. If you go back in time and see at the cases that present from January, there might not have been tested for adenovirus. There's no blood available that we can send for further testing. The tissue might have been stored in a different way. So absolutely. And I think it's a bit early to kind of say, but these things definitely should be all taken into consideration.
I hope they will be taken into consideration again as you issue those guidelines. Well, that has been an interesting quarter of an hour. 20 minutes? 25 minutes? I lost track of time just because I was having fun chatting with you and learning about this new disease. But it may be time to start thinking about, well, about you, about your life story, about what was it that prompted you to leave Belgium and come to King's?
Well, I did my medical school training in Belgium, and I had the opportunity when I did my pediatric training. I'm from the Flemish speaking part of Belgium, and I was doing my training in Leuven, and one of the possibilities was to spend a year in the French speaking university kind of in Brussels, and I got to work at UCL in Brussels, and got allocated to work for 3 months on the liver transplant and hepatology unit there, which was an amazing experience. I was working there with Etienne Sokal and Le Mordedang and Jean Deville, and also Professor Jean-Bernard Otso, really eminent group of pediatric hepatologists, and my time was there was really fascinating, and then I was given the opportunity to present some of the work that Jean Deville had been doing at the Alex Morwatt meeting, which was a kind of a meeting organized at King's to celebrate the life and the achievements of Alex Morwatt, who of course founded the pediatric liver unit at King's. And when I was there and I presented the work we did, I actually was encouraged by the team in Brussels to ask whether there was any opportunities to do some of my training at King's. And so I spoke to Georgina Mieli-Vegani and Anil Dhawan, and I was given the opportunity to go and work at King's, and then had to go back for a short period of time to finish my pediatric training, but was asked to come back and work at King's, and I've been there ever since.
I'm thinking about the pediatric hepatology group in both Wallonie and Flandern, and thinking, you know, they send their best people to King's, and what happens? Do they come back and help out? No, they do not. They stay there. What was it like trying to make the transition into Britain?
It was absolutely fine. We, my husband and I, we came together, and we both have been working in London ever since. It's a really multicultural environment, and again, that's what I find fascinating. Particularly the setup of our team, as you know, is very multi, kind of international and multicultural, but also the patient population we see and the population in the area we live is very multicultural, which is so fascinating and
challenging would be one word for it.
Yeah, challenging, but really also widens your horizons and makes you think of things in a different way, because you see so many different ethnicities, so many different cultures, and that makes you become much more flexible and kind of open to other cultures when you meet patients and parents. So I still find that really fascinating and great, actually.
That's wonderful. You have three children. One of them is, I think, already out of the nest, and the others are teetering on the edge.
That's correct.
How have you been able to keep them trilingual, francophone, and speaking Dutch, and of course speaking English? How did you maintain cultural ties with Flanderen?
To be fair, my husband and I, because we are both Belgian and we speak Dutch, they have always been around kind of the languages, and they've always had a kind of at school kind of find it really easy to learn other languages, which I understand is something that has kind of been observed with the exposure to different languages. And I think that is so important, because from my own experience as well, kind of working in the hepatology committee in Espigan, is kind of being surrounded by people from all different European countries, and be able to speak to people in their kind of native language is I think a big advantage and a really nice kind of skill to have, as you know, Alex, yourself. They're doing really well with their languages. They're comfortable going to Belgium and speaking with the families there. It's been an easy commute to Belgium, and I think sometimes it takes us less time to travel to Belgium than it takes for people to travel from London to the north of the UK. So it's been relatively straightforward to kind of commute back and forth and spend time with the family there.
Well, as you know, as we approach the end of an individual podcast, we want to specify that Espagan, as an organization, brings a lot of different nations, a lot of different cultures together in collaboration, but they remain individuals with their own particular flavor. And part of that flavor is, of course, a song that makes them think of home, a song that gives the listener a little bit of a feeling for what it is to be a Fleming, what it is to be Marian Samin at home and abroad. Do you have a song for us?
So it's difficult for me to choose a song because I love music and I sing kind of a lot in the shower, of course. But there's two songs in particular that I'm thinking about. I was part of a really lovely liver transplant school now 2 years ago in Paris, which was organized by Dominique Debray. And as one of the activities, we did a karaoke evening. And whereas we were given just a typical list of the typical karaoke songs, people started suggesting to sing songs from their countries and they're kind of in their own native language. So we ended up singing kind of the whole group together songs in a variety of languages, including Polish, Italian, French. And one of the songs we sang on that evening was the song C'est la vie from Khalid, which is a really lovely, joyful song. And I think that kind of would work really well and represent kind of how people can get together, have a good time, share their experiences and enjoy life.
I know that song and I love it. Fantastic.
If you would like to listen to the song, check out our Spotify playlist, Espigan's Favorite Songs.
Marianne, this is, it's been a treat for me. It truly has. Lovely to see you again. And I hope that those who are listening have had as good a time listening as I've had speaking with you.
Thank you very much, Alex and Salma, for inviting me. And as you mentioned at the beginning, Alex, I hope we'll have the opportunity to talk about young people with liver disease on another occasion.
Wonderful. Until the next time.
Thank you. Bye.